Okay.
There we go.
That's exactly what the problem was. I'm ready to go now. And you're not.
No. What I'm doing is just pulling up all your websites as soon as we can.
Oh, okay.
So you're ready to go. You can start.
Great. Well, thank you, everybody, for having me here in Alice Springs and elsewhere. I'll begin with apologies. This is absolutely the latest I've ever been for one of my own talks. And any later, I would have missed it entirely, which would have been sad, because then I wouldn't have known how it came out. Really pleased to be here in Alice Springs, because my very first awareness of distance learning of any form was as a kid watching a documentary on television, Canadian Broadcasting, and it talked about the school of the air and using shortwave broadcasts to sheep stations and things like that. So to me, this is like returning to the beginning, returning to where it all began. So it's a special experience for me. Topic today is called Blogs, Learning Objects. There should be an S on that. And that's what happens when you create a slide before you've had your first coffee. And other cool stuff. Mostly it's about other cool stuff. I've got a great deal of material to cover today. And but I think you'll find it very interesting. I'm not going to talk so much about learning objects. And if you came expecting to hear all about enterprise learning management systems or the 87 fields of IEEE LOM or stuff like that, I'll touch on that ever so lightly. But I'm going to move in a different direction, as part of the title, the blogs part, suggests. And I'm going to talk about what might be called small e-learning or distributed e-learning or student-centered e-learning, rather than the centralized corporate systems with publisher-produced content on a broadcast model. Because I think that, although that's where e-learning is going today, I think that we're in the mood for a shift, if you will, or we're poised to make the transition. And just as the music industry has been shaken by things like Napster, I think e-learning is going to be shaken by some of the new technologies that are coming up. Just so you know, although it's already being recorded here in the studio, I'm also recording this on my own computer. I'm using a little piece of software called Audacity, Audacity. It's a wonderful little application. It's free, which I really like about it. You can store up to 24 hours of audio recording on your computer at any given time, and if you want to do more recording, you just move some of the recording you've already made elsewhere. I discovered that yesterday. And this little Sony condensing mic, and if you want to know exactly what it is, it's an ECM ZS90. This combination sitting on my laptop has turned me into a mobile recording studio. I'm getting CD quality sound. It's absolutely outstanding. And as I was commenting yesterday to Graham, if you think the music industry had problems with Napster, why do you see the problems they have with things like Audacity? And that's kind of the theme of this whole talk, is we're going to move away, yes, even in e-learning, from learning and learning resources that are produced by central publishers or production agencies, to e-learning that is produced by ourselves, and even more importantly, our students. And I'm going to run through a bunch of tools, all of which are free, all of which are open source, all of which are available now, that you can install and run even on very small computers. And that's where I think the future of e-learning is going. As was said in the introduction, not yet. Sitting there with the finger poised to move the slide. I read once that you should always have something to say before your first slide, because it's not about the slides. The slides, whip together the slides, it's about the talk. And even though I'm talking to many remote locations, and I'll learn where those locations are after the talk, although I know where many of the cities and towns are now. It's still about the talk and not the slides. As I go through, anyone here in the room and anyone online, do feel free to ask questions. I'm not going to worry too much about staying on pace because, you know, if I lose my pace, I'll just rush through some stuff. No, I'm kidding. These slides will be on my website, www.downs.ca. Downs is spelled with an E, D-O-W-N-E-S. As well, once I get some bandwidth I can work with, the audio of this talk will also be on my website. So all those preliminaries done. I hope it's a good talk for you, and we'll get going. And now you can hit that slide thingy. Where I'm going to begin is not with blogs or learning objects at all. I'm going to begin with a technology called the wiki, and I'll ask the group here. And I take
technology isn't good at it.
I take it they can signal in, right, with a hand up or a yes no, or
they can actually call in. Or they can signal with the flag that they understand.
Okay.
That's directed. Except I haven't got that wiki across yet.
Right.
We might just run it another way in a second.
All right. Well, I'm just going to ask while you're doing that, the people here and the people online, how many of you have heard of a wiki? A couple? Fewer than half? Okay. Do you think that's fun? We're about to go to one in just a second here.
Yeah,
how are we doing online?
We're
going
to get to it another way. I'm going to decide it. I'm going to go to your wiki this way.
Okay. What a wiki is a wiki is just like a website. And you can hit Downs Wiki anytime there.
Come on, it is Downs Wiki.
Okay. Looks.
You want me to click on this?
Yes, please.
Interesting.
Yeah, we'll see how this works. All this technology here, and I've still broken it.
No, you've done very well. There's certainly going to be a functionality of our system. I've just got to share. I didn't realize that we had to share that.
I'm sorry.
No, you're doing very well. You're making me work like a dog.
Excellent. All right. What we've got up on the screen there is a wiki, and it looks just like any other web page. And in fact, a wiki is just any other web page. But if you scroll to the bottom of the page, you'll see a link there. All the way. People have been adding stuff. A link there that says "Edit this page." Just click on that.
Just make this a little bit smaller.
Sure.
See our page.
Oh yeah, it's helpful. People can see what I'm talking
screens.
About.
And
click on "Edit this page."
That
one? Nope. Right above it. Now, the neat thing about a wiki is every page in a wiki, and a wiki may have many, many pages, every page in a wiki has one of these "Edit this page" links. You see, this isn't broadband.
this is one make five, just fine.
And the point of a wiki, there we go, the point of a wiki is that any person visiting the site can edit the page. There are no restrictions. So if you type something in there, and maybe at the top, maybe not remove the "Hello Cairns" because they're still important to me. "Hello Alice Springs" or "Darwin" or anything, and give it a line after, and now hit save. And what we've just done is edit this wiki page on the fly, and we'll get a little acknowledgement screen. And then where it says "click here" to see the page, we'll click here.
Sorry.
No problem. You've never seen these pages in your life.
Right.
That's part of the proof of the technology. And we'll see. It might be a little small on your screens, but you can see right at the top there where he's typed "Hello Darwin" and "Jabiru." We've just changed the page of this wiki. And that's the whole concept. Now, there are things like wiki markup to make the formatting of a page easier. For example, if you can see on the screen there, it's very small, but you see on the screen there a little table that I've made it alone. I meant to spell one, but 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, etc., and then I ran out of numbers. So that table was created simply by typing a pipe character, and then the first table cell, another pipe, and the second table cell, and that's it. That's how you create a table in a wiki. If you want to create a link in a wiki, you just type the URL and it becomes a link. It's beautifully simple technology to use. And wikis are typically coded in a language called PHP. PHP, again, is free software. It's a programming language. And it'll run on the computer that you set up with a free Apache server and the free database software called MySQL. These things, this software doesn't require a lot. You can run it on a typical desktop. I run, they call it the LAMP configuration. Linux, Apache, MySQL, and Perl or PHP. I run that off my desktop. I run it off my laptop. I run it off everything. It takes a little bit to get going. You know, it might take you a bit of time to get used to the technology if it's new to you, but once you're there, you're not paying any money, and you have this tremendous interactive capability. We back up to the slides. Now, you might think, how could a wiki possibly work? Because anybody can go in and change it. There's no moderation, there's no control, there's nothing. Anybody in the world can change your screen. But if we click on Wikipedia, Wikipedia is an online encyclopedia made entirely using...
I'm just going to get back.
Yeah, no problem. You do your thing and...
Thanks. Press the wrong button.
Yeah. I pressed the wrong button oh so many times.
He's sort of never done it this way before, which is really good, actually. So, well, yeah.
Well, it is good because I like pushing people a little bit. So
that's good. It works for me.
Yeah, and it's maybe a little less good in that it doesn't always work the way we expected it to, but that's okay.
We're away.
Right, we got Wikipedia on the screen. Wikipedia is an encyclopedia. It's created using a wiki, which means anybody in the world, including you, if you log on to this, can contribute to an encyclopedia article. There won't be things blocking out the bad words and so on. You just put in whatever you think is appropriate. And if the rest of the world thinks it's good, it'll stay. And if they don't like it, it'll be removed by the next editor. And this is the way a Wikipedia works, right? It's collective editing. And the way it works is that people want their stuff to stay, which is kind of interesting because people don't get any credit for contributing to Wikipedia. There's no bylines or anything like that. But they like to see their sentences there. So they put the sentence in such a way that most people would like the sentence the way it was. And so the articles tend to be very accurate, very informative, very balanced, and it works. And it works beautifully. About a week ago, Wikipedia issued a press release. They somebody created their 1,000,000th article. This is an incredibly huge, rich, and diverse encyclopedia. To get an idea how diverse, there's on the left-hand side, there's a thing that says random page. And if you go to Wikipedia, click on that a bunch of times. And you'll see articles about everything. Wikipedia has more content than Encyclopedia Britannica. There have been academic studies done. The content is about as accurate as Encyclopedia Britannica. Although, of course, it's much more up to date because it changes daily. It changes by the minute, actually. And it has much more comprehensive listings. There we go. You get a listing for Polaris, a comic book superhero. Okay. You won't see that in Encyclopedia Britannica. Is it popular? Wikipedia has more readers than Encyclopedia Britannica. So, basically, Wikipedia, this little piece of cheap software, and more powerful servers funded entirely by donations, has basically put Encyclopedia Britannica out of business. Oh yeah, the corpse will linger on for a little while, but choosing between the two, really there's no choice. You go with Wikipedia. Let's back out of that, and we'll advance to Okay, we're not going to go to that link. I had a third link in my slides that was to an online presentation entitled The Fuss. It was put together by three very smart people, Brian Lamb, Darcy Norman, and Alan Levine. They work in three separate cities, Calgary, Vancouver, and Phoenix. And they never even met each other until they got together to do this presentation. It was conceived, organized, and presented using a wiki, and it was about wikis and blogs. Great presentation. You do want to go have a look at that. Lots and lots of links. The main thing I wanted to emphasize with this little introductory bit about wikis is the ease of use and the facility with which people can come in and change content. This is user-generated content at its best. Now, the next slide here talks about content management systems. And these are for people who want something more formal. Go ahead, sure.
People deface the wikis and stuff like that.
Yeah, people do deface the wikis, and I was doing a talk in on Sunshine Coast, and I actually went in and defaced one of the wiki pages in Wikipedia just to show that yes, it can be done. I decided not to do it too often though, because that's annoying. The way a wiki is set up is it keeps track of every previous version of the page, and so if you see a page that's defaced, you can look at the previous version, and if the previous version is a non-defaced previous version, by clicking on one link or one button, you can revert to the previous version. So it actually turns out it's easier to restore a site than it is to deface it. And things get defaced in Wikipedia. I mean, they have content in Wikipedia about, you know, the Palestinian Israeli situation, for example. And, you know, stuff got defaced back and forth on that for a long time before they settled into that happy medium. And there was a lot of just restore previous page. So, you know, you have slogans or obscenities or whatever. They don't last long. They last a couple minutes. The way people know that a page has been changed is a Wikipedia will keep a list of recently changed pages. And you can actually choose which pages to track. There's a million pages, right? And it just scrolls like crazy. So you can keep, and people adopt pages. So you can keep an eye, look at the recently changed page list, see if the page has changed, go in, have a look. And at any given time, there's a certain number of people having a look at any of these pages on Wikipedia, and they get changed back very quickly. All right, content management system. I'm not going to linger long on this. Mainly, I want to tell you that they exist. If we'll zip into... we're going to test you a little bit again. Okay. The top link on Scoop.
Great.
I think we'll be all right.
Yeah, fine.
It's just see if we can handle a login.
Yeah.
This is Scoop. This is a content management system. Again, it's free. It's written in Perl, which is another computing language just like PHP. It's free. It's really convenient and handy to use. And it was set up essentially to create newspaper sites, journal sites, things like that, hence the name. And if we type in, and maybe I'll type my password.
All right. Not make a new account then. You want to just log in, do you?
Just, yeah. Oh, well, we need to actually type the username and password in first, because we'll just get the same thing all over again.
Yeah.
All right. I have to remember what it was. Yeah. You ready?
Dog.
Oh, you got a key tracker?
No. At home, I do, but not here.
Okay, this is the administration side of Scoop, and it doesn't really look like much. Maybe I typed in my password wrong. No, I think I'm... Yeah, there's all the admin tools. You see all the admin tools down there? New story list, archives, you can create polls, site controls. You can set up and organize these blocks that are on the page. Topics, you can sort your site into topics, any sort of topics you want. Create special pages, create user groups, RDF feeds, which I'll talk about later. You can include advertising, you can manage subscriptions for an email version of it, so on and so forth. If we scroll back up closer to the top, mm-hmm. and see where it says submit story, we'll click on that. And you can set up Scoop or any of these content management systems so that either the administrator or members or just anyone can submit a new story. So we're going to submit a story here. There's the title. We'll give it a... Oh, sorry. Yeah, well, let's choose the section news. It'll punt me if we don't choose a section because I've got it set that way. So title, give it a title, whatever the title may be. Mice. We'll scroll down just a wee bit. Now you're going to pay for that. Write something about mice in that window. With the caps lock on, yeah. Oh, it doesn't have to be spelled, right? Lot of mice in the work. Click submit. And we've just submitted our story.
And your name.
Yeah, well, it's under my name. So. This version of Scoop that we're using is just a test installation I'm running on my website. And besides that, as the administrator, I can go in and delete the story or edit it or whatever. But let's go back to the front page. Oops. The link that says front page. That's good usability says there should be a link to the home page underneath the logo. And you can see that we have created a story titled Mice on the front page, and it's a very short story, but you know, typically articles in Scoop would be a bit longer because it is intended more for journalistic type stuff, and that's updated, the world can see it. That's Scoop. And if we back out to the slide now, I'm not going to follow up these other links, but these links are there. Post Nuke. Well, let's pop into Post Nuke. We have time. You know, so forget. I'm just going to make sure while we're waiting for that to load that I'm still recording over here. Oh, yeah, we're doing fine. Okay, this is Post Nuke, a very similar system. It tends to be used more for community-oriented sites. So if you have a community of practice, people who are interested in, say, frogs, or other things, they would set up a Post Nuke site. They'd report their frog sightings, they'd upload their frog pictures, so on and so forth on this site. And it supports discussion boards and so on, as well as items. I'll just add an item to this site, so I'm going to log in again. So we're down here. I want to log in because Post Nuke, like Scoop, also allows for story moderation. So if I just try to submit a story as an anonymous user, I'm going to have to log in anyways in order to approve the story. That's the way I've set up my site here. So many options. With Post Nuke, you can design this, basically completely reformat this screen, use whatever templates you want. If you did a search out there on the internet for examples of Post Nuke sites, you'd see a wide range of designs. In fact, a lot of the sites that you visit even now on the World Wide Web are published using Post Nuke or Plone or Drupal. You don't even know it. You don't even see it coming in. I see it because I recognize it, because there are some things that they have in common. You can sort of pick them out, but you really have to be looking to pick them out. So, we're in our administrator here. Let's submit a story. So I think it's in the upper right here.
Oh, sorry.
Where did we go? Oh, right. Let's go to administration, please. This is the administration menu. And out of the box, it comes with little icons, but I don't like the icons. So add story. And because I have this set up so that only administrators can add stories. And this will look pretty familiar. There's a title. You've got the drill by now, I guess. Maybe this one. Make this one about frogs. Don't give it a topic.
Oh, Linux and Post Nuke.
Yeah. I have no imagination. I only have one category. I could add more categories. And we'll, that's an Internet Explorer artifact.
So what do we need to do?
Just type your story, whatever it is. If you are doing paragraphs, you just do double space for paragraphs, so on and so forth. Frogs are green. Some. All right, scroll down a wee bit. This is a great system because I'm actually describing what needs to be done to do the submission, so I think it's, you know, a bit more animated that way. PostNuke allows you to write a little short introductory paragraph, and that's what will show up on the homepage, and then extended text, and there's where you can throw in your 1,000, 2,000, whatever words, and that will be what people see if they click on a link. So, you know, it'll say on the front page a little paragraph, and then read more, you click on read more, you get the extended text. And notes for yourself, so on and so forth. And I think we can just, instead of, well, let's do the whole preview thing. Click on submit. Programming this story, what that means is you can set the exact time and date you want the story to show up on the homepage. So you can make it look like you're publishing something daily when really you just pull them all night or Saturday nights and pre-program everything. All right, so there's our story. We'll scroll down to the bottom now, and all the way to the bottom, and see where it says preview story. We'll change that to post, hit submit, and give it just a couple of seconds here, because, you know, this is actually quite literally coming from halfway around the world, 12 and a half hours off of what time it is in my home, which makes calling home interesting.
It's going out to our optus too, so.
Yeah, well, that doesn't help. And we'll just click on home there, and
home is.
Yeah. And here's our updated post nuke site, out of the box configuration, because I didn't really have time to do any formatting or anything. And there's the story, frogs are green. And if there was extended text, we can click on the extended text. Notice here in the post nuke stories, there's a little comment link. People can add comments and so on and so forth. A lot of the times, these content management systems will come with a built-in bulletin board system. Typically, they'll use PHPBB, which is a free bulletin board software that runs, as the name suggests, on PHP. And that typically just comes with the PostNuke or whatever install. So, again, back to the slides. As I said, there are some others, Drupal, Plone, there are others. A variation on the theme, and it really is just a variation on the theme, is something called Moodle. This is the only time I'll really talk about learning management systems today. Moodle is an open source learning management system, and for people who are in the content management system game, they'll realize, oh yeah, this is a content management system with an attitude. Okay, no, I shouldn't say that. Moodle has a lot of instruction-specific features. It's based on a constructivist learning model. It allows for a lot of interaction and so on. It also is free software, PHP again. So the same point is with the wikis. Very easy to use. The users, if they want to create content, they just simply type whatever's on their mind. The system takes care of all the formatting and things like that, updates the page for you. It's free software. It's a very powerful software. It scales beautifully. Although the way this really should be used is, instead of, you know, one or two big sites, a proliferation of small sites, because you can talk back and forth in that. Go ahead.
You say that yes. Very text-based. Is there options for adding graphics to
Yeah, you can upload images. The wiki has image tags, and also the type of wiki I use, which is called an Erfurt wiki, like the town in Germany, I've taken it out because I don't want it to be. I have limited disk space on my server. They give me 20 gigs. I'm sorry, that's all? What a world we live in. But there's you can have an upload button right on the wiki page. And it's one of those things, you know, It says browse. You click on it, you browse your own thing, you pick your image, and then you upload it. Similarly with the content management systems, you can upload images as well. With any of these things, you can embed any sort of multimedia whatsoever. There's utterly no issue with that, because they are web pages. They're fully functional web pages. In fact, more than fully functional web pages. They do a bit more than just the web. So, yeah, you can go completely multimedia. The lack of images and that on my demo speaks more to my lack of imagination than anything else. Next slide. Yeah. Now we move to blogs. I'm going to ask again how many people have heard of blogs. Let's check and see if the people online are still listening.
Just do a quick check. Oh, look at that.
Right. Oh, yeah.
They're flagging in 57%. You take off a percentage for that thing.
Oh, right.
No one won't answer.
Right.
Unless you get up there and go click.
Yeah, we could do that, but what would the point be? Excellent.
Yeah.
Blogs are huge, right? Blogs are everywhere. Blogs are, you know, the new technology that swept the internet like a wave. I keep predicting that this wave will subside. It keeps not subsiding. I still think it'll subside, but I'm beginning to wonder when. The definition of a blog, because people love definitions, is very simple and straightforward. A blog is a website where a person contributes items on a regular basis, where these items are dated and displayed in reverse chronological order, most recent first. Now, sometimes people have tried to define blogs according to their content, because blogs resemble like journals or diaries, for example. So you'll go out there and you'll see something like a blog is a personal journal or a diary. And it looks a lot like it. But blogs today, there are 4 million or so blogs out there in the world, active blogs, and they are everything. They're far more than personal journals or diaries. You have war bloggers who do nothing but blog the war. You have political bloggers, especially in the United States. You know, these political bloggers that, you know, hurl insults at each other. My website is sometimes called a blog. It's in part a blog, and it deals with educational technology. I have a link here, which I'll show you in a second, of other educational blogs. You do have diaries. If you go to a site, I haven't linked to it here, but called livejournal.com, you do have the stereotypical teenage, angst-ridden teenage girls with their blogs. And there are, you know, tens of thousands of them in Live Journal. But they're, you know, I mean, they're only a part of the demographic, and they're no more or no less represented in blogs than they are in ordinary society. They're professional blogs, sports blogs, hobby blogs. Again, there could be frog blogs. That works really well. That would be a good name for it. It might be taken, though, frog blog. So, just going to pop in. I'm not going to pop into WordPress because I edited the software. I do that, and now it doesn't accept submissions. I pointed out, though, because WordPress is software, again written in PHP, that you can install on your computer. The same one I described earlier, right? The LAMP configuration. It'll use MySQL. Completely free software. You can provide blogs for one or more people. And this is a common use of blogs in education, where a teacher or a tech person will set up a blog for everyone in the school. And some people do it, some people don't. You know, there are uses of blogs out there where the teacher will give every student a blog and then have them use the blog to do their assignments or things like that. That's not really a good use of blogs, because what makes a blog is that it's yours. It's your space. It's where you do what you want. It's where you talk about your interests, your friends, a lot about your friends, your culture, your aspirations, your day, your medical conditions, your research. It's your space. And when the teacher comes along and says, well, you will do such and such in a blog, it takes away from that. So there's this balance. And is it James Richardson? We may have to correct that in the transcript. I believe it's James Richardson. has written a lot about that, about the tension between the typical mode of education where teachers tell and students do, and blogs where students basically do what they want. And, you know, in a school environment, especially if it's on the school server, you can't leave it free and easy the way the blog world is. But on the other hand, any amount of constraints on the blogging takes away from the effectiveness of the blog. And the other thing, too, is blogging is not for everyone. I will pop into Blogger, because if you're too cheap, too poor, sorry, or just simply unwilling to, or maybe you're fighting with computer staff, who knows, to set up a blogging software on your own server, there is a service out there called Blogger. We'll click on that link just as soon as he's done with his phone call here. Okay. Oh, okay. All right, well, we're going to really linger on this site. Actually, I think I can take it for a little bit. Blogger is what's called a hosted service. LiveJournal, which I mentioned just before, is another hosted service. And what Blogger is somebody else set up a site where you can go in and create your own blog. And I'm just going to log in here, if I can remember. We've got to solve this password problem. There are too many passwords. I can't remember all the passwords. Great. So, now we're inside Blogger. Blogger was started by a company called Pyra. And then, a little while ago, it was bought out by another small internet company you may have heard of, called Google. And this has really added a dynamic to Blogger that wasn't there before. One of the things Google did is, like, when Blogger was owned by Pyra, they used to support themselves financially by running a banner ad at the top of every blog. Google took those away. And then what they said is, you can, if you want, you don't have to, add your blog to our AdSense program. AdSense is a system of text ads. And what the way it works is the content of the advertisement is based on the content of the blog. So Google has this whole base of ads that it runs. It does a quick little search. Google can do that and puts exactly the right ads beside your blog. And they'll pay users, they'll pay people who have blogs if they run the BlogSense ads. So Google, instead of you paying Google to use their software, Google will pay you. Now, not very much, sometimes, but if you have a very popular blog, it can really add up. It's completely new for a hosted service to be paying its users to be providing content. But the thing is, the content draws the readers, and that's what makes the ad stuff work. Without the content, you don't have the readers. And it's a shift, isn't it, in this whole dynamic, where it was the publisher and the advertiser, and it was all over there, but now it's the user producing the content, where, well, that sounds bad. A little SOS phone signal. I always wonder why people make their phones go SOS, you know. I don't know. Anyhow, I don't use telephones, so there's a lot about telephones I don't understand. So anyhow, here we are in Blogger, and you're back. You can do the grunt work here. And we're going to create a new post. By now, the methodology is familiar to you. We'll type in a title. Yeah. Notice that the interface here in Blogger is all what you see is what you get, right? So, you know, you can do bold, it'll do all this stuff for the links and image links and whatever, so on and so forth. So he's going to type in his article. He just doesn't even need my instructions anymore. Just, you know, the way it's been shown that this stuff is so simple, people start using it when they're very young. In an article that I'll refer to in just a bit, I talked quite a bit about a place called Institut Saint-Joseph, which is a school in Quebec City, and they've set up blogging software for the grades, their grade 5 students. Their grade 5 students go and they do their blogs, and they have a great time with that. Okay, and he's playing with the fonts here. He's going to make world huge. He's going to change the type style, but eventually he's going to scroll down a bit and click submit. He's converted it to Wingdings, so that was probably an unfortunate place for him to stop.
All right. Sorry, I'll
know. All right, we're back to courier. We'll just publish post. Let's fly to the wind here. Publishing in progress, and we get the neat little icon. And then in Blogger, it's kind of weird. Now we have to republish entire blogs. So you publish a post and you think about it for a while. Maybe I shouldn't have posted that. But it doesn't actually show up in the blog itself until we hit publish entire blog. This may take a few minutes if you have a large blog. I don't. So it should finish almost immediately. How many times did you click that? So this is new. All right. Well, let's just hit Downs there at the upper right, and that'll take us back, or view blog, even better. We'll go see if it actually did show up. And Blogger may be having issues. Yeah, there it is. So that's how easy it is to post to a blog. And again, the same theme, right? Really easy user-generated content. Blogger and blogging generally has sort of expanded a little bit. If you have SMS on your mobile phones, you can message in your blog post if you want. There's a site out there called Audio Blogs, where you can blog audio content, and there you can just phone in your blog content. There are photo blogs, and you can upload photos and things like that. You can send email to your blog, so you send an email message, and that appears as your blog post. Any way you can send content these days, it can get into your blog. So you don't need to be on the computer anymore. You're not tied to the desk. And people, you know, people go out, there's events or whatever, a demonstration. You get demonstration blogs a lot where people go out there with their mobile phone. They're in the middle of a crowd of 100,000 people, and they're texting in live on the spot reports. And some, you know, because they have the photos with these cameras too, they're adding photos. There's user generated dynamic multimedia on the fly. It's just fantastic. And it works anywhere a mobile phone works. So, you know, there's still gaps in the network, but we're getting there. Back to the slides, please.
So that's actually that's a drop on top of
connection to server fail. I guess Blogger got tired of reloading that page. I've written extensively on blogs. A good introductory article, you don't need to click on these, is More Than Personal, The Impact of Weblogs, where it's a quick history and some discussion of just the impact that they've had. Educational Blogging is an article I published in EDUCAUSE Review. It's a longish article, and it talks all about the use of blogs in education, covers the whole thing. And you find that a very useful article. If you're following up and are interested in blogs and educational technology, you might click on this link. The bottom one.
See, unfortunately, I can't see that one.
Oh. Well, it'll show up as a page. I keep a list of educational blogs. This is in something called EduRSS, which I'll come back to in a few minutes. And if we scroll down this, and we'll ignore the ones that say untitled, that's a small software glitch, but these are all blogs written by educational technologists around the world. A lot of these people I know well, just from over the years. We'll keep scrolling there, just give them an idea of how many there are. Edna has stuff.
I got Edna in there.
Yeah, I got Edna in there. And Frank Carver, and I got David Wiley, and Jeremy Allaire, which some of you might recognize. John Udell, Lawrence Lessig. It's not really educational, but I include them anyways.
Just looking for my name.
Do you have a blog?
No.
You don't have a blog, you're not going to be in the list. Robin Good is a very good site. I've got Slashdot, of course. So on and so forth. Huge list. Well, think about this for just a moment. You know, assuming you have internet access, and you know, most of you have some sort of internet access, even if it's dial-up, just slow, but all of this stuff works in dial-up. This one page here basically is a huge resource for keeping up on educational technology and related issues. In fact, this one page is everything you need. Absolutely everything you need. If you've been going to the library and digging up dusty old journal articles and things like that, you can stop doing that. Everything you could possibly want in the field is in this list. And it's updated, well, you wouldn't believe. We'll come back to this in a little bit, but I want to talk a little bit about some of the stuff behind the scenes. So we're going to go back to the slides, and we're going to move on to the next one. And the wonderful world of RSS. This is the most technical page in the presentation. And it's got some squiggles, I'm sorry, but nothing major. If you look on the right-hand side, what you have is a demonstration, a straightforward demonstration of what an RSS file is. And as you can see, or maybe not see, because it's a little small, an RSS file, or an RSS document, or as we call them, an RSS feed, is an XML document, so there would be XML headers in that I haven't shown, that describes the contents of a site, a website, that may have more than one item. Now, RSS was designed originally to describe the contents of newspaper sites. It was created by Netscape back in 1997 to give newspapers a format that they could use to submit story lists. And then these story lists would be taken in by Netscape and displayed on a website that they called NetCenter. Of course, as soon as this came out, other people started using it. I used it for my site, again, in 97. I was Netscape feed number 51. So, I'm very proud of that. Very simple XML. In fact, one of the meanings of the name RSS is really simple syndication. The more proper name, and the name that Netscape gave it, was Rich Site Summary. If you look at the XML markup there, you can see basically two major types of items. There's channel, and then there's item. Channel is the name of the newspaper. So you might have title, the Boston Globe, and then link, bostonglobe.com, right? The title, Wired News, and then wirednews.com. You can add a few more things in channel, but I've left, that's, but what I've put there will work. You don't need anything more than that. It's up to you if you want to add more stuff. Item is each article that's being published in this newspaper. So each article will have a title. Each article will have a specific URL or link where it can be accessed on the web. And usually, not always, but usually, each article will be accompanied with a short description. You know, one paragraph or so. And that's it. Again, there are more things you can add in an RSS feed. You can add the author, you can add the publication date, and so on. The only thing that's required is the title and the link. That's RSS. You now have learned RSS. That's all there is to it. That's the concept. It's incredibly powerful. Now, on this slide, I've put a couple of links. I'm not going to go to them because all you'll see is a bunch of words and won't really help you a whole lot. One of these is called An Introduction to RSS for Educational Designers. It's the top link there. And don't write these links down. Just go to my website after, and not today, but tomorrow, this presentation will be right up at the top of my homepage because I have a content management system. I'll just upload it. So, an introduction to RSS for educational designers. Contents exactly as described by the title. And the next one, how to create an RSS feed with Notepad, a web server, and a beer. has proven to be an enormously popular article, not because of the beer, although I may have contributed to a new brand of RSS out there. This will give you the nuts and bolts of how to create an RSS file from scratch. All the details, everything you need. And the feedback that I've gotten hundreds of comments back on it, and you can see the comments with the article. It works. I mean, you follow the instructions, you have a feed, and it'll work beautifully. So, incredibly fascinating technology, incredibly powerful. We'll move to the next slide anytime you're ready there. Oh, let's go to the next one. We're going to come back to this one. Out of order.
Somewhere else.
Pardon?
Out of order.
Yeah, right. You know, you can be replaced.
I've only got one finger.
The thing with XML, and the whole point to XML, is that it can be read by machines as well as by people. So, when you create an RSS file that describes the contents of your site, it can be read by software out there on the internet. And you might be thinking, well, why would I create an RSS file? Well, if you use a wiki, or if you use a blog, you create a blog in Blogger or WordPress, or if you use a content management system, all of these things automatically create RSS feeds for you. You don't need to do anything. Well, some of them you might need to turn it on. But basically, the RSS feed is created automatically by the software. The XML is created by the software for you. So, if you use any of these tools, you are producing RSS. If you are producing RSS, you are making your content accessible on the web, not only to people, but also to software that reads these RSS feeds. So what does this software do? Let's click on Blogline. One of the things it does, and I'm going to have to log in again, is it allows people to read your content. So, here's Bloglines. This is a hosted service. That means that all the software, again, is at their end. And I just access it using an ordinary web browser. And as soon as he's finished fiddling here, I'm going to log in. And we'll click on the login button. And this Internet Explorer, it won't stay the same size. If you are using Internet Explorer, stop using Internet Explorer. And the precise software that you want to use is called Firefox, which is in fact Mozilla. Firefox is, of course, free. It is open source. Not that that matters. It installs beautifully. It does everything Internet Explorer does except the Microsoft specific stuff. You won't even notice it when it's gone. And it's blogging without the pop-ups, without the viruses. It's a very secure browsing environment. So, and that's the trade-off, right? You don't get all these Microsoft-specific things, but also you don't get the holes that go along with them.
What do you do with the Windows updates requirements?
Windows updates requirements? Mm. What do you mean?
Mozilla pull them down, Windows updates?
I don't even know what you're talking about, Windows updates.
No, when you get to go to Service Pack 2, when your XP product and all that.
Yeah, no, this is completely separate from Microsoft. So, so is that what happens? The Service Pack 2 is advertised on the Internet Explorer, and that's the only way you access it?
But you can automate your system to pull down your Windows updates, and it automatically uses IE. So
that's really evil.
It is evil. Yeah. Mozilla pulls it in?
Not a
problem. Great.
Oh, there you go.
Oh, well, there you go. I like Mozilla.
See, I had Windows XP. I had it for about 4 months, 5 months. Then it died. And it took my computer with it, including about 100 pictures I had taken from Rome. So I will never use Windows XP. Never, never, never. On my laptop, I have Windows 2000, and that's only because the wireless modem that's installed in the laptop is proprietary technology. It's a Dell laptop. They use their own chipset. So, well, not their own, but a special chipset. And so there are no Linux drivers for that wireless modem. Otherwise, I use Linux at home. I use Linux in the office. I have my wife's computer set up with Linux, and to me that was the acid test, because she doesn't get into, you know, the back end of things. She uses it an awful lot, so it had to be really robust, had to work really well, and it had to be trouble-free, and it is all of those things. So Linux, you know, don't go home and install a Linux disk into your computer right now. That would be incredibly unwise. It's not ready for prime time, you know, unless you're really comfortable with computers. But if you have the opportunity, and if you have a spare computer kicking around somewhere, or if you like to live dangerously, then install Linux. Or if you know somebody who is experienced with Linux, they can set up your computer and it'll run beautifully. It'll run just as well as Word, and you'll have, or as Windows, and you'll have most of all of that Windows stuff.
It's a free product.
And it's a free product. And even more importantly, all the software that runs on it is free. Your PowerPoint type thing, your word processor, Audacity, my sound recorder runs on Linux. There's image editing called GIMP, which is a really unfortunate name, but so on and so forth. But that's all a digression. I'm going to log into Blog Lines here, and this is probably reporting my login back to Microsoft. I'm not paranoid, am I? Let's click in there. Now, what BlogLines is, you create an account on BlogLines, and what BlogLines allows you to do, you see right in the center screen there, it says subscribe. If you know the address of an RSS feed, any RSS feed, you just paste the address into that, click subscribe, and you're subscribed. Most of the time, when you go out to websites, blog sites, content management systems, or whatever, there'll be a little orange button that says RSS or XML, and that is always the address of the RSS feed for that site. So you can just right-click, even in Firefox, you can just right-click and copy the URL and then paste it right into this, click subscribe, and you're subscribed. On the left is the list of my subscriptions. I've expanded it a little bit just because. And now what this list is, this is a list of RSS files that I subscribe to. And click on OL Daily there at the top. OL Daily is my newsletter. I'll come back and talk about that in a little bit. It has an RSS feed. Here is BlogLine's version of me reading my RSS feed. So you can see the... There's the link to the talk that I did up in Darwin the other day, e-learning in easy pieces. As you can see, I can put links right inside the description part. The title there, that's just the title from the RSS. And then the text you see, that's what I put in the description field, or more accurately, my software put into it. I don't hardly ever code RSS by hand anymore. I was able to put links in that. One of the things I do that's different from, well, everyone else, is I have at the bottom of my description three links, refer, research, reflect. And what that does is take the reader into some of the services that I offer on my website. I don't use Drupal or PostNuke or anything else. I wrote my own system in Perl. And the reason why I did that is so that I can do things like this, refer, research, reflect, and so on, and just take the technology a little bit further. We'll come back to my system in a little bit. So, another neat thing, and I just want to boast about this a wee bit. Click on, let's do the short one, DOS-L. DOS-L is a mailing list. You're familiar with mailing lists, I assume?
Yeah.
And they're a real pain, because, you know, especially if you use Outlook, then it's a real bad pain. Plus, your system might die. I'll use a free email program called Thunderbird. It's part of Firefox. And Thunderbird works with NRC, which is where I work, the National Research Council of Canada. They use the Microsoft Exchange server and all the overhead that entails, but Thunderbird just connects right up to it, grabs my headlines. It's like 3 or 4 times faster than Outlook, because it doesn't have all this traffic going back and forth with the server. It doesn't have a need to have this long, involved conversation about who knows what. So it does very simple things. It lists my email, it gets my email, and then it sends email. Anyhow, but even with Thunderbird, mailing lists are a pain. Because, you know, there's spam, and we've got spam filters and all that, but I still get stuff through, and then, you know, it's just, it's hard to read on an email reader. So what I did is I created a little script that got the archives of these mailing lists. So it goes to the internet, retrieves the page that lists the archives. It analyzes this page and converts them into an RSS feed. And I publish that RSS feed on my website. Then I told BlogLines where it is, and this is the result. This DOS-L is an RSS feed being displayed in BlogLines of a mailing list. This is how I read my mailing list now. I don't do it in email anymore, because this is so much easier. I can, like, these are busy lists, you know, 20, 30 emails a day. I can miss it for a few days, no problem. I just go to this page, zip right through it. And if I click on a link, just click on a link there. Anyone, doesn't matter. And I'll go right to the email message itself. I've been looking at the listserv software itself, and I'm pretty sure there's probably a way to standardize it. But right now, I've had to write separate, just because of the styling that they use, I've had to write separate scripts for each of these email lists. But listserv stores its archives in a very standard way, and if I can just understand that standard way, I could write one little script that will work for any listserv mailing list. It's on the horizon. It's just, I'll need about a week to sit down and work this out and actually get into listserv and poke around with it a little bit. This is so much easier. And you notice there's no spam, because it's pull. I bring in the stuff I want, right? When I use an RSS aggregator like this, I choose the feeds. I go out to the web and bring the stuff in. That means I bring in only what I want. And what I want is this stuff and not spam. Email is push. Other people out there decide what they're going to send you, and you have to live with the results. And that's why you get spam. And there hasn't been a lot of discussion about that on the web, and in our field especially, but there's a huge difference between push and pull. Push is the publisher model. They'll push stuff at you, whether you want it or not. And it's, you know, it's some content you want, advertisements, spam, viruses, the whole works. Pull is user-centered, or in our field, learner-centered. We decide what we want, we bring it in when we want it. And it's a completely different world. And most of the problems on the internet today are caused by push. And if you just look at the mathematics of it, there are 1 billion web users out there. Push will not work, because there's no way to effectively select or to filter out the total content of these 1 billion people. We do a pretty good job, but, you know, even the smallest little crack means it just comes flooding in, because there's 1 billion people. But pull, we can pick and choose from those 1 billion people, like we choose our friends. And that's much more manageable. Let's zip out of here, zip out of blog lines. I'm not going to go to Technorati. They will improve, but they're having server issues, and they've had server issues for a while. What Technorati does, and Feedster does the same thing. Maybe pop into Feedster and see what we see. You got one of those mice too. Is that a ball mouse? Sell your ball mouse or give it away.
Get an optical.
Use one of these. This will cost you the same. Yeah. This is a LabTech. Microsoft makes them too, but I use LabTech.
I just got to get a mouse and a little LabTech.
Like that. You will never go back to the ball mouse again. I tell you. Anyhow, what these sites do, TechnoRowdy and Feedster, is they harvest all the RSS feeds. That's why they have server issues. And they bring them together into a whacking big database. And now you can do stuff with it. If we type in anything there, whatever you want, maybe frogs or fish or... Well, okay, let's make it a word, because I don't want to pick out just... We'd probably get results. Horse. Okay, this could be dangerous. So anyhow, he's typed in horse, and what we're doing here is we are searching through all the content in all the blogs that have been published, all the posts that have been published on those blogs. Usually it's faster, but that looks like an error there too, doesn't it?
I'll just go in there.
Yeah, usually it pops right up. It's not usually a problem. But nice. We're going to get a whole bunch of computer pages now.
Yeah, there's an error on the page.
Yeah, there's an error on the page. Well, that's unfortunate. Usually it works. But again, like, Feedster and Tech... Let's try TechnoRowdy. Let's see what happens then. Just back out of this and go to TechnoRowdy. So, and I'll say now, expect issues. We are expecting and experiencing an outage. Okay.
Does that mean they're out? Apparently?
Yeah, they're out. Feedster's out. So much for that part of the demo. Anyhow, well, and it's because they harvest 3 million blogs, several hundred million blog posts by now. It's really hard to manage. Oh, here we go. We got something from Feedster for dogs. Okay. So we got a little advertising off the top. Isn't that fun? That's new. That's one of the problems with Feedster. But we'll talk about the solution to that problem in a bit. But if we scroll down here, the neat thing about this is, yeah, they're really having a problem. The neat thing about this is this is the stuff that was published in the world of blogs. We call that the blogosphere. Published in the world of blogs today.
55,000.
And, yeah, 55,000, and that's where they cut it off. Now, this is unusual. It's saying published 21 hours ago. Usually it's like published 21 minutes ago. So I guess Feedster's having issues at the moment. Like, this is a right up to date content on whatever topic you want. Now, let me tell you how I use this, because I don't use Feedster or whatever to search for dogs or things. Google has become very good at picking up the content of blogs. So you're just going to do a search of everything. I just search Google. But what Feedster and TechnoRowdy do better than Google is give me stuff that's published right away about me. So I go to TechnoRowdy and I type in downs.ca, and I get a list of the sites in the last, 24, 48 hours that have linked to me. Usually it's all blogs, right? Or all things that have RSS feeds. Same with Feedster. Usually I just type downs into Feedster. I don't very often type downs.ca, so I don't know what I'll get here. Because TechnoRowdy works on URLs, and Feedster works on keywords. If you just get rid of a .ca there, just type downs. Get rid of a .ca. Yeah. Right, that should do it. You know, it sounds like vanity surfing, right? In a way, it is vanity surfing. But, it is so useful because...
presidential debate.
The problem with Feedster is it picks up everything from our EduRSS as a downs item, which is really annoying. So I have to do a lot of scrolling to pick up the good results. But... now it picks up my own newsletter as well. But anyhow, that's why I prefer to use TechnoRowdy for this example. But TechnoRowdy is experiencing an outage. So I get all of these blogs, and they're commenting on things that I've written. And I go and I read the comments, and I might add a comment to their site, or I might blog it myself. And what happens is we get a conversation going. I say something, they say something about what I said, I talk back to them, and away we go. And that's how this stuff works. That's how the blogosphere works. As I wrote in the educational blogging article, the publication of a blog is only the end result, the logical end result of a long process. But the process involves mainly tootling around the blogosphere and reading stuff that's interesting to you. And when you see something that's worthy of comment, then you put something in your blog. So I tootle around, and you know, I sometimes do more directed things. I've got a couple of alerts set up so that I get posts on e-learning and online learning, stuff like that. But mostly on these services, I set up, I search for my own name, and I get all kinds of content, interesting resources. I meet and talk to people I've never talked to before, and the community is created. It's my connection to the rest of this community. Incredibly powerful. More powerful than email, because it's easier to use, and it's much more selective. It does not resemble in any way the traditional broadcast, I speak, you listen model. It's very much a conversation, and nobody's in control. They run their blogs. They say whatever they want. There's no moderators going to tell them, you know, don't insult Stephen, he might affect our funding or whatever, right? People write what they want, and I write what I want, and so it's a very free-flowing, open conversation. And it's new. It's just something that we haven't seen on the internet before prior to blogs. We saw it a little bit in Usenet. We saw it with mailing lists a little bit, with discussion boards a little bit, but nothing so unstructured and open as the blog network. And RSS makes this happen. Let's back out of that. And where do we want to go? Let's back up to the previous page now. In our field, the academic field, there's also a separate parallel initiative called the Open Archives Initiative, or simply OAI. And they've pretty much done the same thing, but for academic papers, journal articles. In the great world of OAI, there are right now more than 1 million, I think probably up about 1.2 million and counting, of course, journal articles, academic journal articles that are available through this network. And by available, I mean at a certain point you click on a link, you read the paper. The main site is at OAI. What OAI? We don't need to go there. But we could if you have time. But how would you know that? I love people keeping people in suspense. OAI is a set of Perl scripts. Well, it's mostly a protocol, I should say. Some standard ways of organizing what they call an e-print archive on an institutional website. Of course, you don't have to put it on an institutional website. You can put it on your desktop and still work. They do provide software. It's a set of three or four programs in Perl. And what it does is it produces a feed, just like an RSS feed, of all the journal articles that are located on a given site. And each institution would have its own, right? These feeds are written not in RSS itself, but in a very similar language, XML language called Dublin Core. A lot of crossover between RSS and Dublin Core. And in fact, RSS has a Dublin Core module that allows RSS to completely emulate Dublin Core. Dublin Core, sadly, has no RSS module, but it's not needed. So, again, what happens is you have something like a blog, not a blogger, blog lines or Technoradio or whatever, access these OAI feeds and bring them in. And in the world of OAI, a program that does that is the one we see up on the screen here, Oyster. And, oh, okay, it's more than a million. It's 3,488,842 records, so it is up since quite a bit since the last time I looked at it, from 347 institutions. These would be colleges and universities around the world. I don't know why libraries buy journals anymore. I really don't. Why would they? We have this. I don't know why authors send their articles to journals anymore. I don't. I've got lots of articles. Some of them have even been published in journals because they call me and ask me. You know, actually, they don't call me because they can't reach me, but they send me an email. I say, yeah, whatever. What really bothers them, though, is just journals. When a professor publishes a paper in a journal, what the journal typically does is say, okay, now you will give us your copyright to this article. We're not going to pay you anything. We might send you a copy or so of the journal, but we're not going to pay you anything. You will give us our copyright, your copyright, so that we now own the article. And if you ever want to use it again, you have to ask our permission. Professors actually do this. It just kills me. And they send the article to the journal. The journal turns around, of course, and puts it in the journal and publishes it and then sells it back to the very same people who sent them the articles in the first place at these incredible subscription prices. And, you know, in the digital world now, they're setting up online access to these journal sites so that you can read them electronically, and it's ridiculous. They're incredibly expensive, and you authenticate 8 ways over Sunday. You know, it'll do things like track the IP, so if you're not in your office, you can't access this database and things like that. And this is all for stuff that academics gave them for free in the first place. So I think journals are in trouble. I think journals are in big trouble because the stupidity of the system becomes evident as soon as you think about it. The only thing that's preserving the system is twofold. One, professors need journal publications in order to get promoted. And two, a number of journals have very good reputations in the field. Now, these are not good foundations on which to sustain a business. Already things are shifting in terms of promotion. There are open journals such as the Public Library of Science, which is an open access free journal. You access it electronically, which has already attracted some prestigious articles. So, you know, the field is shifting. The traditional, very expensive journal is on the way out. My advice to libraries now, right now, at this point, now, stop buying journals. Just stop. Don't buy them. Period. And instead, take some of the money, not all of it, but some of the money you were spending on journal subscriptions, and use it to set up an archive for your own staff. And if everybody does this, we have everything we had before, and it's at a fraction of the price, because it's a lot less to set up one of these archives than it is for journal subscriptions. I can set up a LAMP configuration. Basically, I need a computer and an internet connection. Of course, all my software is free. So you can do it for much, much less. Now, I'm glossing it a little bit, but only a little bit. And you know, I'm trying to convince my own organization, National Research Council. We have an entire whole division called SISTI. I don't know, it's Center for something, 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 which basically buys books and buys journals and centralizes them and makes them available to our 1,700 researchers. I'm basically saying, I don't want to say, you can't say shut down SISTI because you get a revolution on your hands. But I'm saying, like, stop doing SISTI, stop bringing the stuff in, and instead set us up so that NRC people can put their publications on the NRC site and make them available for free to the world, which is what we were doing before. It's just that the publishers sort of intervened partway through. Question? Comment?
Just one last thing. I'm just wondering whether we should have a quick 10-minute break. Would that then give you enough time to complete your thing or not?
Yeah, I'll be all right with it.
You sure?
Yeah.
I'm just wondering if people wish.
Do people want a 10-minute break?
Well, there is some food out there. I don't know who dropped those in. Well, somebody dropped some sandwiches and everything in there.
Yeah.
It's up to you, honestly. Honestly, I don't.
Let's do 10 minutes, and I can adapt. I've got some good stuff, but now I'm recording. It creates multiple tracks, and it's okay. It looks bad on the screen, but this Audacity. Excuse me, Audacity. When you export as an MP3 or whatever, I save all this in MP3 because everybody can use it. It'll schmoosh all these tracks together and give me a nice single file. So
schmoosh, that's a good technological word.
Yeah, I use a lot of technological terms like schmoosh and tootle about and gibbled. If your text doesn't come through properly, it's been gibbled.
Anyhow, I'm for that.
So that's Open Archives Initiative, and we're going to move on now, and past aggregators, because we covered that. Oh, yeah. Okay. Now, let me move into the stuff that, because as I was mentioning in the break room, I've basically, through the years, I've been at this for, I was online since 1987. I've been coding online since 1990 or so, and I've actually written software that does a lot of these things before the commercial version came out. My own website, downs.ca, and again, you'll find all of my articles and my papers and so on my website, uses a lot of this stuff, or has versions of this stuff that I wrote myself. And I put up a few links here. The main one I'd like to point you to is OL Daily. This is, it's not actually daily, it's five times a week, but it was close enough. This is basically a blog. I've been doing this one since 1998. I've been sending the email version of it out since 2001. And I get a bunch of subscribers. And of course, it's free, of course. And you can sign on to this anytime you want. Sign up for it as a newsletter in your email, or as an RSS feed, so on and so forth. We're back out of this. So any of the talks and so on that I do will be listed there. Articles is articles. We don't even need to click on that. One of the things I've also done is all of the blog entries that I've done, I toss into my own database. And I've created a research page. You just click on that link. And I actually use this. I created all this for myself because I find these things useful. And if you look at the research page here, I've actually now organized it by topic. Each one of these topics is a dynamic topic in the sense that I create the topic using a regular expression. I can change the definition of the topic and add new topics, remove new topics. I think of categories. Now, people get hung up on the whole concept of taxonomies and categories. I think of a category as a predefined search. That's all it is. Nothing more, nothing less. And so what I've done is I've set up a system of organizing my website as a series of predefined searches. That makes the listing of categories very dynamic. We just click on Blackboard there, and basically you can find anything I've written in the last 6 years or so. Unfortunately, it doesn't display brilliantly here in Internet Explorer. There should be a space between the items, but this is all the stuff I've written on Blackboard over the years. A very powerful, useful tool. If you click on one of the research links, remember the refer, research, reflect. If you're reading my website and you click on research, that takes you into this research database. We'll just scroll down a little bit, and it gives you access to anything the author wrote, anything that came out of that publisher, and it lists the categories it's currently classified under and gives you access to those. And then reflect takes you, we won't go there, let's do that. We'll go to reflect. Just click on reflect right here. Yeah, now that takes you to a discussion area where you can submit a post. And if we zip back to my home page now.
There should be a home on the top there.
Yeah. And one of the things that I've done, and this has made a really big difference on my site, is you see where it says community on the lower right? I have a little JavaScript feed that picks up the contents of my discussion board. So anything anybody submits using Reflect to my website, and I pop it right on the front page. Put it on the front page. I used to have it on an interior page, and I had a few posts every once in a while. I put it on the front page just before I came to Australia. I've had constant traffic on it. Put it on the front page. Get it right up there in front. The discussion needs to be right there in front and accessible and really easy for people to use, and then it becomes really powerful. I haven't read some of these, so... I like that. Stephen said, I'm just reading one of the posts. Stephen says, gosh, why would we constrain our definition of learning to such outmoded, hierarchical, linear, and obsolete concepts? And then the person says, I think if you reread the article, I am not constraining the definition. Your definition includes anything and everything, which is correct, just not particularly, I'm sure it goes on, useful. That has got to be Rory McGreal, who's a I think he's the Associate VP of Research at Athabasca University. We've had this long conversation about the definition of learning objects. Anyhow, and then you can read the entire post or the entire topic and so on. All of this is an aside. But anyhow, the back end of my site, we don't have time to go into it, is a content management system. It looks a lot like PostNuke. It looks a lot like Drupal. But I have my own ways of defining contents, and I have an interface which is a little more suited to my preferences. This code isn't available yet, but I'll be making this all available open source at some point. So certainly, you know, there's Drupal and there's PostNuke, and there's less of a point to it now, but I find it really handy. Let's go back to the slides and go to the next slide. Now, talked about... This is where things get really kind of cool. We talked about RSS. We talked about aggregators. One of the things that I've done is I've written an aggregator. And we'll go right to that link now. I called this aggregator EduRSS. Remember that list of educational blogs that I showed you before the break? EduRSS goes to and gathers the RSS feed from each one of those 200 or 300 educational blogs. You see the difference? Technorati harvests 2 million sites. I harvest 200. This is the first layer of filtering. Right? I'm filtering for a certain kind of content. The reason why I do this, in addition to not being able to afford the supercomputers that can harvest 2 million weblogs, is I get really good search results. Because if, for example, somebody searches on EduRSS for Edna, they get Edna, the Australian thing, not Edna the person, or Edna the movie character, or whatever, or Edna the blogger. So, by constraining the harvest to a particular area, I can really improve the search results. Now, another thing I do, oh, let's just pop into top link, today's EduRSS. EduRSS harvests once an hour. So the content's right up to date. This is all Atlantic time here that we're seeing, which is 12 and a half hours of what off of what we are. So the most recent link is 10:02 p.m., so about an hour ago, not even. Networking 2004 program, now online. They must have planned this. because, of course, I harvest from the Australian Flexible Learning Framework. I will be participating in Networking 2004 on the first day. I'm not sure what I'm doing yet, but I'm doing something online. And I'm likely to be doing the same thing I did last time, which is a daily newsletter called Net News, which summarizes networking. Probably. I'm not positive. But anyhow, the program's now online. Now, if you scroll down here, just zip down through it, there's an awful lot of content. It's too much content. It's too much for everyone but me. I say that because I go through this. I zip through this. Actually, I miss days. I feel really badly, but I do miss days. It is too much content, though. It's still not useful. So let's go back to the EduRSS page. Just hit the back button. Or wherever it is. Yeah, no problem. Okay. What I've done, remember my research site, right, with all the dynamic topics? I apply those topics to the incoming data from EduRSS. So if we click on EduRSS topics, so here are my topics. And it'll take a couple seconds for this to come up, because there we go. So here are all the different topics. And what I've done in turn is I bring all of these RSS feeds together. They're filtered, and then I pull the items out according to topic. So I have topic-specific pages. Let's click on any one of those topics there. Action learning. That's actually a kind of a quiet topic, but there's stuff. Yeah, I know. Yeah, the last link was June
24.
It's funny, you know. I thought it was a good topic, but there's new stuff in Cancor, I think, maybe. Oh, chat and chat rooms or whatever. Any topic. So here's a page dedicated to that specific topic, coming from these 200 or 300 feeds, and this is like a daily newsletter on a very narrow topic with 300 authors, and none of whom get paid. and I'm one of those authors. You see the top link has come from my own newsletter, OL Daily. And anyhow, if you look at the top of the page, or if we go back to the main screen, what I've done is created RSS feeds for each one of these topics. So now look at what we've got. We've got a layer of filtering where I select the sites that I'm going to harvest from. We have another layer of filtering in the topic selection. We've got two layers of filtering, then it gets sent to you. This is very focused information. You can subscribe to this in blog lines or with a desktop RSS reader or whatever. Or if you click on that little JavaScript link, I also have a thing set up whereby if you take this little snippet of JavaScript and put it on any web page, it'll put that feed right on the web page automatically for you. So if you want up-to-date content and learning objects on a web page, there it is. Now, you might think, okay, well, that's kind of cool, but where's the practical application? Let's back out of this and we'll go back to the slides. Because remember I talked, I'll go to the next slide, remember I talked about how I wouldn't talk about learning objects a whole lot? Well, we now have 10 minutes, 11 minutes, and 25 seconds left in this session, and I'm now actually going to get to learning objects properly so-called. And what I've done is, with this whole sort of technology, blogs and wikis and content management systems and RSS, taken all of that and applied it to the concept of learning objects. Now, the definition of a learning object, more or less, is digital content used to support learning. Now, what that has resulted in actual practice is a set of specifications, 87 item, XML file definition, large learning management systems, enterprise learning content management systems, very much a publishing model, a CD model, a push model, right? I've changed that. I've set up the Distributed Learning Object Repository Network, which is exactly the same as EduRSS. Uses the same technology, the same concept. It harvests RSS feeds from selected sites, it organizes them, it makes them available as feeds. Except, not blog posts, learning objects. Let's click on that link. So, we go into DLearn, which is what it's called. And we can see the contributing... Well, okay, here are the learning objects that were contributed today. Yeah. Let's go to contributing feeds, please. Okay, here's where I harvest from. Oh, right, let me fix that. I really need to fix this link. have a typo on the page. It's a known issue, but I keep forgetting to fix it. Delete button. Right, the big thing that says delete. There we go. Let's bring it up. So here's where I harvest from. I've had to convince each one of these practically. Sometimes it took more convincing than others. Cario, which is out of Calgary. Common Content, which is from Creative Commons. Edna, which you may be familiar with. UK Center for Materials Education. Merlot, which is a US-based learning object repository service, so on and so forth. Not a lot. People haven't, the learning object industry hasn't bought into the picture yet, but I've got enough that to show the concept. Let's back out of that. Twice. Well, let's click on today's DLearn listings. And the stuff is coming in. Slowly. There's only two items today. Isn't that interesting? Usually there's many more items. But today there's only two items. And it looks like a duplicate. I don't know why Merlot is sending out duplicate listings in its RSS feed, but it obviously is. Anyhow. So, the idea here is that DLearn does the same sort of thing for learning objects as EduRSS does for blogs. And the concept is, because originally, way back before the big companies took a hold of it, the idea of learning objects was, these were things that we would create and share, and it would make all of our lives easier. And then the companies took hold of it, and it became this mechanism of organizing and distributing highly secure, authenticated, published material that could work on a CD-ROM. That was their main focus, and was the typical page-turner type of thing. And they've advanced beyond page-turners now. They have a specification called learning design, which is kind of like a flowcharted page-turner. So there are some decision points. But basically, it presents the contents, and the students consume the contents, and if they're lucky, they'll hit a quiz once in a while. That's the idea of online learning being presented here. What I'm talking about is learning resources created by instructors themselves, for themselves, or even better, by students. And the students create the learning resources. They use all of these self-publishing tools to get them into the system. They publish an RSS feed, them or their class or whatever, describing these learning resources. Something like DLearn picks it up so they can subscribe to other people's learning resources. They can use these, they can share them, they can put them on their website, just the way I did with my comments, for example, or with that JavaScript thing. It becomes, instead of this broadcast model, it becomes this web of content flying around. And the way I describe this on a more theoretical level is, as we move into the world of multimedia, the language that people use, especially in education, changes, and or we might say goes back to where we were originally, where we're not working in text and paragraphs and things like that. I mean, they don't go away, but they become, instead of being everything, they just become one thing. And the new words, the new vocabulary that people use, and especially our students, is a multimedia vocabulary. It's a multi-threaded vocabulary. It's a random access vocabulary. If you look for my paper, Learning Objects in a Wider Context, on my website, it'll be under presentations. You get more of this picture. And e-learning becomes a conversation, where people create these things on the fly with their cell phones, with their cameras, with whatever, and they send these things back and forth, these resources that they trade with each other. And some of them are just captured on the fly. Others are the result of research projects or whatever. I mean, I've heard a lot of stuff here in Australia about some of the neat projects where students are producing resources on this, that, and the other thing. I wish I could remember the details off the top of my head, but one project that was talked about yesterday, I think in Darwin, was the digitization of Aboriginal cultural artifacts that for the last 30 or more years have been sitting hidden away in a museum. Nobody can use them, see them, or whatever. And they're being brought out, they're being digitized. And it's, you know, it's not a publishing company that's doing this. It's researchers and teachers and students. And they're doing it not to make a profit, because this is interesting information. It has cultural value. It's part of the language that we speak, and it should be shared. And this kind of network is the kind of thing that does this, rather than the centralized broadcast model of learning management systems. And I believe, I'm totally convinced that what we're going through now in e-learning is just a phase, and where we're going to end up is something a lot more like this. And the software is only being written now. It's being written by people who aren't really very good programmers, such as myself, but eventually good programmers will come along, and they'll take these concepts and they'll make things that really scale and really work well. I just want a couple more slides here. So, RSS LOM is just simply the RSS format for learning objects. Because I've talked about content throughout this talk. There's a whole other field out there called social networking. And, in fact, it's become a branch of mathematics called graph theory. And there's an awful lot of interesting stuff, and there's some implementations already online. These are crashing and burning for various reasons, but Orkut, which is another of Google's things, or Flickr. Basically, the idea of social networking is you log on, and then you have a list of friends. I forgot to put the link in there. In the RSS world, the same concept is known under the heading of friend of a friend, or FOAF. If you do a Google search on FOAF, you'll find out about this. And it's not there yet, but if you mix the content exchange, I'm just going to blast right through that phone call because I have 2 minutes. If you take content exchange, learning object exchange, and then you build networks of friends using something like FOAF, you get what I call the semantic social network, which mixes connections between people and connections between content, and it allows us to weave these wonderful webs of content and people and resources and time and everything. And this isn't abstract theory. It's not something I'm pulling out of the air and saying, ooh, this would be neat. There are people like Duncan J. Watts has written a book called 6 Degrees. And there are a couple of others. There's a book out there called Nexus. There's another book out there called Linked. There's a whole series of these, and then there are some horribly abstruse journal articles, open source journal articles, because I've read them, with awful mathematical squiggles and things like that, describing the mathematics of how these networks work. And these networks work beautifully. And the same principle that links these networks together, the mathematical same principle that links together something like the semantic social network, is the same principle that will tie together the various elements of an ecosystem, say, like a food web or something like that. It's exactly the same mathematics that describes how crickets communicate with each other when one of them chirps and they all chirp. It's the same mathematics that describes, you know, how when people are clapping at a rock concert or something like that, and then all of a sudden everybody's clapping in unison? It's this emergent phenomena that comes out of a web like this, and this is what happens in social networking. Again, the mathematics are known. This is not speculation, this is not New Age mumble-jumble kind of stuff. This is solid, it's demonstrated, it's empirically valid. The same mathematical principles that describe the growth of cities, river channel distribution, the patterns of branches on trees, is the mathematics that describes social networks. That's why I think this, rather than these centralized systems, is the way of the future, because it is known to work. It's more, if you will, in harmony with nature. Last slide. Okay, I'm not going to talk about this slide very much, but this slide is just talking about how to make learning objects properly so-called the product of people rather than of publishing companies. XSLT is a way of taking a basic web page, a way of taking a basic XML file, like an RSS file or like anything else, and turning it into, well, anything, a web page, a Word document, a PDF file, whatever, Braille. And so it's funny, with all the talk of standards and things like that in learning management systems, we've never had an XML format for learning objects themselves. I find this incredibly odd. And I have my conspiracy theories, but this is explorations into that. It's not a published work or anything like that, but it's stuff that I've been playing with. If you go into that site, you'll see a learning object written in XML. You'll see the XSLT I used to transform it. And I also added some JavaScript to give it some dynamism, some moving parts, and CSS to style it. And this becomes very powerful, very portable. You can do it all in Notepad, and it works. It works beautifully. Next. I can't. I'm already late. Recommenders, follow those links. There's a whole science of this, because I'm talking about information going one way through the network. Evaluations, ratings, is information coming back the other way through the network. It's that conversation happening. It's feed forward, feedback. That's the principle of this whole thing. Aggregate, repurpose, remix, feed forward. That's what we do. That's what instructors do. That's what students do. That's the model. Last slide. So there we go, the way forward. Small pieces, blogs, wikis, content management systems, your photo phone, loosely joined, very loosely joined. This whole concept of enterprise e-learning and that, and these big, huge, tight systems is like the Titanic. And loosely joined gives us stability, gives us flexibility. Fast, furious, out of control. Read Douglas Rushkoff, Rushkoff, especially a book called Siberia. It's a few years old now, but it captures that flavor. As I was saying earlier, content as vocabulary. Take this seriously. Multimedia is the new language. This is not a metaphor. This is what is happening. People are speaking in multimedia. They are thinking in multimedia. If you do a search on Amazon for a book called The Synaptic Self, you'll see that the way their brains are structured is changing. Actually, there are various other people who write along these lines. So our medium of exchange, we've had this period from like Gutenberg to now, where we've had this really artificial, fictional representation of the world in something very abstract, which is text. We don't want to lose that. It's a very powerful tool. But we're coming through that period now. And the way we talk, the way we think of the world, is going back to pictures, going back to stories, going back to audio, going back to experiencing rather than listening, immersion rather than observation. So it's a very new environment that we're moving into, and it's a very powerful environment. Marshall McLuhan, a Canadian philosopher, was the first, I think, to really see this, but we're living it now. This is happening now. It's, our children are already in this world. Well, your children. I don't have children. And if you want the real rock-hard, technical, nuts-and-bolts description of the architecture underneath all of this, that last link there is called Resource Profiles. Tells you how to do it from at the very nuts and bolts level. So, I think I've got a consistent picture here. I've got a picture that has living evidence in the world of blogs and RSS, you know, the two technologies that have actually worked on the internet, and the only two technologies that don't have official sanctioning bodies or standards committees. Nobody's telling people how to do RSS. Nobody's telling people how to do blogs. They're just evolving all by themselves. I've got the mathematics that describe how this works. I've got empirical evidence in the world around us, everything that we look at, and I've got working technology, actual scripts on my site that I've linked to here, and I've got the theoretical principles as far as computational processes in this resource profiles paper. It all fits together as a package, and I don't know what more you can want as a science or as a way forward. I think this is it. But if you don't believe me, there's a lot of people who will talk to you about learning object metadata and the importance of taxonomies. So I'm 7 minutes late. I don't want to miss my flight. So I really, I wish I could spend more time. I will be back tomorrow. If you want to chat, I'd love to chat. Those of you who are online, I know you're a long way from Alice Springs, and I'm sorry I can't get to your communities. I wanted to go to your communities. It just wasn't time. But, you know, when I come back, you know, I want to go to places like Catherine and Broome and stuff like that. Yeah, he's telling me where everyone else is.
Jabiru, Nullumboy.
Yeah, I was in Jabiru the other day, actually.
Nullumboy. Tennant Creek.
Tennant Creek. I want to go to these places. I want to experience your world and the networks that surround you and hear your stories, because that, to me, is learning. And that really is what I'm all about and what this is all about. So thank you so much for your time. I really, really appreciate it. I love this country. Thanks.
Thank you. And for everybody out there in the distant world, thank you very much for your time. I hope you got a lot out of this this talk. I know I did. And your appreciation would be pleasantly seen. If you flagged, that's the best you can do for clapping, you lot. There we go. Oh, my database turned up too.
Good timing.
That's right.
And I'll stop there.